It seemed that every word would hit the governor, the chair, and the draperies about him and rebound. At any rate, they were sent with such force that the governor trembled and the draperies fluttered as though they were blown by a strong wind. There was no question of an interpreter. The governor did not need one. He understood perfectly, although the words were spoken in the purest English. Buddha turned and walked to the two men who had received the gold pieces and asked if he might have them. They handed the discs to him and, with these in his open hand, he walked back to the governor and addressed himself directly to him, saying, "Put forth your hands." The governor did so, but they were trembling so greatly that he could scarcely hold them out. Buddha dropped a disc in each hand and almost instantly it disappeared. Buddha said, "See, even pure gold will fly from your hands," and the two discs landed almost simultaneously on the table before the two men that had first received them. Buddha reached out both hands, placed them on the governor's outstretched hands and, in a mild, calm voice said, "Brother, you need not fear. I do not judge you. You are only judging yourself." He held his hands thus and stood quietly until the governor became calm. Then he removed his hands and said, "You are quick to fly with your swords, to redress what you judge to be a wrong. But remember, when you are judging and condemning other men, you are judging and condemning yourself." He returned to Jesus' side as he said, "We who know, stand together for the common good and brotherly love of all mankind." He again linked his arm with Jesus and said, "Well, brother, I think I took this affair out of your hands entirely. It is all in your hands now." Jesus replied, "You have done nobly and I cannot thank you enough." They turned and bowed, then arm in arm walked through the door and disappeared. The room at once broke into a hubbub of voices. The governor, commander, soldiers, and guards all crowded around to shake our hands. Everybody was trying to make himself understood at the same time. The governor spoke to Emil and he raised his hand for silence. As soon as he could be heard, he said the governor would like us again to be seated at the table. When all had resumed their seats and quiet had been restored, we saw that the commander had drawn the soldiers back into formation at each side of the table and back of the governor's chair, which had been drawn near the table. The governor arose and, with Emil acting as interpreter, said, "I allowed my zeal to get the better of me, for which I am heartily ashamed and doubly sorry. I do not think it is necessary for me to say this after what has happened. I believe you can see by my attitude that I have changed, and I wish to ask Brother Bhagat to arise and accept my most humble apology." "Now will the whole company arise?" After they had risen, he said, "I ask you all to kindly accept my most humble apology. I extend to you all a most hearty welcome and, if you so desire, I hope you will stay among us always. If you wish a military escort at any time, which I judge you do not, I shall, and I know the commander here will also, deem it a high honor to be of service to you. I cannot say more. I bid you all good night. Before you go, I wish to say that everything I have is at your command. I salute you and the soldiers salute you also, and they will escort you to your quarters. Again I bid you good night and salam to you in the name of the great Buddha, the Celestial One." The commander, making profuse apologies and saying that he was certain we were in league with the Celestial One, with five of his soldiers escorted us to our quarters. As they left they gave us a salute, which is executed by forming a half circle around the commanding officer and presenting their swords so that their points just touch the point of their commander's sword. Then they turned quickly, swept off their hats, and salamed very low, touching one knee to the ground. This salute is given only on great state occasions. We accepted the salute as best we knew how and they departed. We went into the house, immediately took leave of our friends and host, and prepared to go to our tent. There were so many of us that the rest house had not accommodated all, so our camp had been set up in the enclosure at the rear of the house. Chapter 14. When we were summoned to breakfast that morning, the leader was the first one up. He hurried through his morning toilet like an eager schoolboy. After he had finished, he urged everybody to more haste. We finally went into breakfast and found Emil and Jast. The leader went over and sat between them and asked questions throughout the meal. The moment we finished eating, he arose from the table and wanted to rush off again to see the house that had grown in 15 minutes, as he expressed it. He put his hands on Just's shoulders and said that if he had two like Emil and his mother, what fun he would have going around and growing houses for poor people. Then he said, "But would I not make the landlords in New York look sick? I pay rent to those fellows." Then Emil said, "Suppose they would not let you grow houses for them?" "Well," he said, "I would do it anyway, and, after I had grown them and they would not use them, I would pick them up bodily and put them in and chain them." All of us laughed heartily over these things. As our party was so large, it was thought best not to go in a body to see the little house. It was arranged that we were to go in groups of 5 or 6. The personnel of the first group was to be Emil, the leader, 1 or 2 of the ladies, and myself. We started out and Emil's mother and our hostess joined us. We walked on until we came in sight of the house. The little girl came running out to meet us and threw herself in Emil's mother's arms, saying that her brother was strong and fine. As we reached the house, the mother of the child came out, dropped to her knees in front of Emil's mother and began telling how she adored her. Emil's mother put out her hands and assisted her to her feet, telling her that she must not kneel to her, that what she had done for her she would do for anyone, that she was not to praise her, but the Great One, for the blessing she had received. The little boy opened the door and the mother motioned us to go in. We followed the ladies in, with our hostess interpreting for us. There was no question that the house was there. It contained 4 rooms and was very comfortable. It was surrounded on 3 sides by the most miserable hovels. We were told that the occupants of the hovels were going to move away, as they thought the house was of the evil one and might destroy them if they stayed. Chapter 15. Emil told us that there would be a meeting that evening somewhat like the one we had attended at his home village the year before and invited us all to attend. We accepted with keen delight. Just before the appointed time for the meeting, Emil, his mother, and I went to the child's house for the mother and sister, as they had asked to go with us. On the way from the house to the meeting place, we passed a number of dilapidated mud huts. The little girl stopped before the door of one of these, saying that a blind woman lived there and asked Emil if she might go in and bring her to the meeting if she wished to come. This he gave her permission to do. The girl opened the door and stepped into the hut, while we stood waiting outside. In a few moments she reappeared in the doorway and said the woman was afraid and motioned for Emil to come to her. He went to the door and they conversed for a few moments. Then both entered the place. Emil's mother said, "That child will yet be a power for good among these people, for she has the ability and determination to carry out whatever she undertakes. We have decided to let her handle this in her own way, except that we direct and assist her, guided by what we perceive as the thing best suited to give her more confidence in herself. Let us see the method she takes to induce this woman to be present at the meeting. The fear that these dear ones hold toward us is beyond belief. Many are moving away from the vicinity of the little one's home, when you would think they would besiege us to assist them in obtaining homes like it. This is the reason we are obliged to be so careful of their feelings. While we desire to lift them all from their surroundings, as we did those dear ones, they flee from us at the first sign of our approach." I asked how she was able to help the child and her parents as she had. She answered, "That it was through the attitude of the child and through her we could help them all. She is the balance wheel in that household, and through her we will reach this dear soul and many more here," indicating the huts that were about. "It is these that we love to bring close to our hearts." That little home was not brought forth in vain. Here Emil and the girl appeared, saying that the woman wished the girl to wait for her and they would come on in a short time. We went on, leaving the girl with the blind woman. When we arrived at the meeting place, nearly everyone had assembled, and we found that the high priest of the monastery was to be the head spokesman of the evening. We were told that Emil had met this lama about 18 months before and a warm friendship had been formed at that time. This meeting had been arranged and we were there at the lama's special request. This had been the occasion for their visit to us the last day on the desert. We were also told that the governor was next in authority under this man. A number of the surmises of our leader were confirmed, but our friends showed no fear whatever. Emil said that both of these men were going to be their close friends from that time on, and that it was seldom they were able to reach those as high in authority as these two, but they were content to let matters move on slowly. We were told that the preceding evening was the third time that Jesus and Buddha had appeared visibly to help them, and they seemed pleased that we had been there to witness the scene. They did not seem to look upon it as an added triumph, but as an opportunity to enable them to cooperate and work with these people. At this time the girl entered, leading the blind woman. She found a seat for her charge, a little to the rear and at one side of the room. After the woman was seated, the girl stood facing her, holding both of her hands, and, in a moment, she stooped forward as though she were speaking to the woman in a low voice. Then she straightened up and, letting go of the woman's hands, placed her little hands over the woman's eyes and held them there for two or three moments. This movement seemed to attract the attention of everyone in the room, from the high priest down. All arose and stood looking at the child and the woman, while the high priest walked rapidly over and placed his hand upon the child's head. As he did this, the child's frame shook visibly, but she did not change her position. The three remained thus for a few moments, then the child removed her hands and cried out joyously, "Why, you are not blind at all, you can see." She pressed her lips to the woman's forehead, then turned and walked over to our chief. She seemed somewhat bewildered and said, "I spoke in your language. How did I do that?" Then she said, "Why does not the woman see? She is not blind anymore. She can see." We looked again at the woman. She had risen and, clasping the robe of the high priest in both her hands, she said in the native tongue, "I can see you." Then she looked around the room with a half-dazed air, saying, "I can see you all." She let go of the priest's robe and, burying her face in her hands, sank back into the seat she had been occupying, sobbing, I can see, but you are all so clean and I am so dirty. Let me go away." Then Emil's mother stepped forward. Standing directly back of where the woman was sitting, she placed both her hands on the woman's shoulders. The priest raised his hands, but not a word was spoken. Almost instantly, the woman's garments changed to clean new ones. Emil's mother removed her hands from the woman's shoulders. The woman arose and, in a dazed, perplexed way, looked around. The priest asked what she was looking for, and she replied that she was looking for her old clothing. Then the priest said, "Do not look for your old clothes. See, you are clad in clean new garments." She stood for another moment as though wrapped in perplexed thought, then her face lighted up with a smile. She bowed very low and resumed her seat. We were told that this woman had been blind for more than 25 years, and that the blindness had been caused when the eyeballs were pierced by fine shot from a gun in the hands of one of a band of robbers. The excitement had been so great that our party had crowded around. The leader, meanwhile, had worked his way to the little girl, and they were conversing in low tones. He told us afterwards that the child spoke English very well. Our hostess had interpreted when the conversation was carried on in the native tongue. Someone suggested that we should be seated at the table. As we began taking our places, the woman arose and told Emil's mother, who had stood quietly at her side, that she would like to go. The child stepped forward, saying she would go with her and see that she arrived home safely. Here, the high priest asked the woman where she lived and, upon being told, said she must not go back to that filthy place. The girl said she was expecting to have the woman stay at her house, and, arm in arm, they left the room. When we were all seated, the dishes were placed on the table as though by unseen hands. At this, we saw the priest start and look around in wonderment. But when the edibles began to arrive in the same way, he turned to Emil's mother, who was seated at his right hand, and asked if this was a regular occurrence with them, saying that he had never been privileged to witness this before. He turned to Emil, who was interpreting for us, as though he would like some explanation. Then Emil explained they were able to use the same power that was used to heal the blind woman, to bring forth all that they needed. It was quite plain that he was still puzzled, but he said no more until the meal was well underway. He arose and, with Jast acting as interpreter, said, "I believe I can see more deeply than I imagined human beings could be privileged to see. Although my whole life has been spent in the order of the priesthood, in which, as I supposed, I was serving my fellow men, I observe now that I was but serving self far more than I was serving my brother. How this brotherhood has been extended tonight, and my vision has followed that extension. I am just now allowed to see what a narrow life we are living, that we have lived despising everyone but our own people. This vision allows me to see that you are of the sublime as well as we, and what a celestial joy the vision allows me to behold. Here he paused with his hands half upraised, while a look of surprise and pleasure flooded his countenance. He stood in this position for a moment, then he said, "This is nonsense. I can and will speak in the language you speak. Why can I not do this? I see what your thoughts were when you told me that there was no limit to man's ability to express. I find that I can speak directly to you so that you may understand." He paused for a moment as though to pick up the thread of thought, then spoke without the aid of an interpreter. We were told afterwards that this was the first time he had spoken in English. He continued, "How beautiful it is to be able to speak directly to you in your own language. With the broader vision this has given me, I am consumed with wonder as to why men look upon any of their brothers as enemies. It comes so clearly that we all must be of the same family, the same source, the same cause. Would that not determine that there was room for all? If one brother chooses to see differently than we do, why should we say that he must perish? I see we cannot interfere, for, if we interfere, we but retard our own development and isolate ourselves. If we do this, our house will fall and crumble about our own heads. Now I see, instead of a limited race, a universal, eternal, limitless all coming from the one and returning to the one. I see that your Jesus and our Buddha lived by the same light. Their lives, as well as all others who live in and by that same light, must merge into the one. I'm beginning to see where it all converges. The crystal clear light is shedding its radiance over me. I believe that man elevates himself to a regal position, but often, when he has gained that position, he can no more see his brother as regal. He wishes to be regal himself and his brother to be the serf. Why did that child place her hands on the eyes of that dear one whose eyes were closed? I see now that it was because that child saw more deeply than I, who should have had more knowledge. It is what you call a mighty love. It is the same which caused Jesus and Buddha to stand together, at which I did wonder, but I wonder no longer. Now I see that it does no harm to include you all, for, as we include you, we have the good that you have and that can but benefit us. I can see that the power which will always protect you will protect me. The armor that protects me will in the same way protect you. If it protects you and me, it must protect all. The dividing line has disappeared. What a celestial truth! I see your thought when you say the world is God's world and the near and far places are His. If we see the near and far places together, they will be the same to us. We live in a place surrounded by our own world, not seeing the fact that outside our little world the whole wide world surrounds us, and that world will help us if we will let it. Then to think that God surrounds one and all. I now see the Holy Brother's thought when he said the doors are to be thrown wide to those who are ready to receive. It is said that man shall not only give ear, but he shall become that which he claims to be, and, sinking self, he shall be immersed in the brotherhood of man. It is deeds, not fine words, that endure. I can see that the way of progress is not only barred by the greeds of others but by those of ourselves. Each is directly claiming the graces of the Most High, each attempting to build up his own by dismantling and tearing down all others. Instead of using energy to tear down, that energy should go to consolidate the whole. The Most High not only made one nation of one life but of one life all the nations of the earth. The time is now come when we must choose between creeds and the brotherhood of man. Creeds are but the conjurings of man. The faith that moves mountains still slumbers in the seed of the plan. The height and grandeur are still there for man to attain. The law of enlightenment has preceded that of miracle. This law of enlightenment is the higher law of love, and love is the universal brotherhood. I now see that all that is needed is for each to return to the fountain of his own religion, to remove all false interpretations and cast out all selfishness. In each will be found the pure gold of the alchemist, the wisdom of the Most High, your God and my God, not many gods of many people, just one God. It is the same God who spoke to Moses from out of the burning bush, The same God of whom Jesus spoke when he said that through prayer he could summon legions to sustain him in his hour of mortal struggle in doing the work the Father had given him to do, the same God to whom Peter prayed when he was released from prison. I now see the mighty power that can be summoned to the aid of those who will cooperate in the brotherhood of a consecrated life. Here he raised a glass and held it for a moment in the palm of his hand. He became very still and the glass crumbled to dust. Then he continued, "The armies before Jericho knew of this power when they blew their trumpets and the walls of the city fell. Paul and Silas knew of it when they released themselves from prison." Again he stood for a moment in perfect silence. The building rocked and swayed, great tongues of lightning flashed, and two great masses of rock became detached from the mountainside about a mile away and came rumbling down into the valley below. The villagers came running from their houses in terror, and we could scarcely restrain ourselves from doing the same, so violently did the building rock and sway. Then he lifted his hand, all became quiet, and he continued, "Of what avail are armies or navies, when man knows that God has this power and that his true sons may use it? You can sweep an army away as a child blows the down from a thistle. As for great battleships, they may be dissolved like this glass." Here he lifted the plate upon which he had deposited the powder that now represented the glass. He breathed upon it lightly, it burst into flames and disappeared entirely. He again resumed, "These legions come not to do your work or my work or to use man as their instrument. Man may call upon them to encourage, sustain, and comfort him in his work as master of every condition of life. With this power man may still the waves, control the winds, quench the fire, or direct the multitude. One may use them only as he has mastered them. He may use them for the good of the whole human race, or he may use them to drive home the meaning of man cooperating with God. One who is able in his divinity to call upon these legions, knows beyond question that he can use this combined power only in true service to humanity, for he knows that it will consume him as well as defend him." Here the speaker paused for a moment, stretched forth his hands, and in a measured, reverent voice, said, "Father, it is our great pleasure to have these, our dear friends, with us tonight. It is with a true and humble heart that we say thy will be done. We bless them, and in blessing them we bless the whole world." He sat down as calmly as though nothing out of the ordinary had taken place, and all our friends were calm, but the members of our party were on tiptoe with excitement. Then the invisible choir broke forth with "All know the power that's in a name, and man may proclaim himself the king, and then with humble mien, that man may rule himself supreme." Chapter 16. Jesus was seated at the first table and the priest at our table, with Emil and our chief on either side. This time there were but two long tables down the length of the room. There were no coverings, but, as we were seated, the tables were covered with white linen, and the service came on almost as quickly. The food seemed to come with the plates, with the exception of the bread. A loaf appeared on the table before Jesus. He picked it up and began breaking it, placing the pieces on a plate. When the plate was filled, a dim childish form lifted it and stood silent until seven plates had been filled and seven forms stood holding them. As Jesus broke the bread and filled the plates, the loaf did not diminish. As the last plate was filled, Jesus arose and with outstretched hands said, "This bread which I present to you represents God's pure life. Partake of that pure life which is always of God." Then as the bread was handed around, he went on to say, "When I said, I am lifted up, and that by being so lifted up I would draw all men to me, I knew that, in the light of that experience, some day all would see eye to eye and know full well when they could be lifted up as I am lifted. I saw heaven right here on earth among men. This is the truth that I perceived, and the truth will make all free. Then they will find that there is but one fold and one shepherd, and if one strays, it is safe to leave all the 99, to seek the one that he may return. God may be all in all to all his children, and all are his. They are far nearer and dearer to him than the sparrows or the lilies of the field. If he rejoices in the lilies' growth and notes the sparrows' fall, how much more does he note the growth of his dear children? Neither does he judge them more than he does the lilies or the sparrow, but holds them dear to his great cause, and not one can be left out when his perfection is established. I could see that, If this ideal could be graven in letters of purest gold on the walls of the temples of the world's great thought, it would lift men's thoughts above the murk and mire by setting their feet on a rock, a sure foundation, where the winds and tides could lash and roar but, while men stood steadfast and true, they would be secure. Because of this security, peace, and calm they would aim to the heights where they see their true dominion. They may soar above but they will not find heaven above. They will find it right among men, and it is not reached by merely plodding on and on, in toil and sorrow and great tribulation, and then eventually finding the great jewel. It is much more quickly reached by throwing off all materiality and the laws that thereby bind men to the eternal wheel. Then step forth, you pick up the jewel, incorporate it, let the light shine forth, and you have gained by one direct step that which you may put off through all eternity, if you will. You will find that the soul which insists upon immediate and complete spiritual illumination and emancipation here and now and knows that his relation to God is the relation of parent and child, quickly sees that this not only makes clear the divine possibilities but that he has them to use and they will work for him as he wills. To that one, the New Testament story will not be fiction nor a vague dream that may happen after death but an ideal that is lifted up before the world, of a perfect realization of a life of love and service. That ideal is the divine accomplishment of all, here and now. Then will they know the vision I saw when I said, many shall seek to enter in and shall not, for strait is the gate and narrow is the way that leads to eternal life. For, without the true appreciation of the Christ ideal and of the divine and perfect plan of the cooperation of man and God right here on this earth, the realization of this ideal is impossible and it becomes only a dream, a myth, nothing. The door giving access to this omnipotent and transforming alchemy of the spirit in man is open to all at all times and the key to its opening is in the thoughts of all. When two ideals and methods of salvation or of securing the saving grace of God's love are different, it is man's thoughts and not God that made them so. Those who close the door to the immediate blessings of God for all his children, isolate themselves from the immediate blessings that God bestows upon the Christ child and from the spiritual illumination of the transcendent alchemy of spirit and the all-potent powers which are theirs to use as the Christ would and should use them. When men recognize this, the leper will be made whole instantly, the withered arm will be restored, and all diseases of body and mind will vanish at their touch. Through the concentration of the spoken word, they will multiply the loaves and fishes, and as they break the bread or pour the oil for the multitude, it will never diminish but there will always be an abundance left. They will calm the raging sea or tempest by their command and gravitation will be overruled by levitation, for their command is the command of God. Then will they know my thoughts when I gave forth my opening message to the world as I left the temple that day, when I said, the time is fulfilled and the kingdom of God is at hand, and, have faith in God, nothing is impossible to you. All who believe they can do the works that I do and will come forth and do them may do even greater works than I have done. They will know that it is a process of living the life, believing and knowing, then absolutely nothing is impossible to them. They will know that the Holy Spirit, the whole of the Divine Spirit in them, says today just as it did long ago that, if they hear its voice and harden not their hearts, they will find they are the light of the world and they that follow that light shall not walk in darkness. They will know that they are the door by which all enter into the light of life and those who will go in and out by that door will find eternal peace and great joy and will discover that now is the accepted time. They will find that the Christ but opens the door to their own souls and the spirit that dwells therein is the all-potent alchemy as limitless as the universe of God is limitless. The alchemy will dissolve and transmute all manner of sickness, will erase clean the mortal life of guilt and the effects of sin, will illuminate the soul with the perfect light of wisdom, will emancipate from and dissolve the darkened conditions of human life into the perfect light of life. Thus, they will see they are not only children of nature but children of God as well. They will bring forth the absolute perfection of the individual and thus will perfect the race. They will bring forth the ideal and the divinely inspired prophecy concerning the final destiny of man here on earth, the identity of Father and Son, which is the second birth, the perfect mastery of man over every condition and circumstance. Here Jesus paused and the lights became brighter and brighter. Then pictures began to appear. The scenes were glorious bursts of splendor. The pictures would come on, a transforming hand would reach out and touch them, and they would develop into a great whole and become beautiful. There came on a great war scene.